Parshas Ekev. So in the parsha that we read this week, the Torah goes into a long discussion. Hashem is promising the Jewish people about going into Eretz Yisrael. And he tells them that you're going to be coming into a wonderful land, an incredible land flowing milk and honey. It's a land of wheat and barley and all the other fruits that Eretz Yisrael is blessed with. Streams and springs come out from the valleys, from the mountains. Then it goes on to describe the beauty of the land. And then the pasuk says, but you should remember, you need to remember to have gratitude to Hashem. You need to thank God for all the blessings. So when you're going to take in and you're going to experience the bountiful blessings of the land, you will eat and you'll be satiated. You should bless Hashem your God. And then the pasuk goes on to tell us, Hishamer lecha, be very careful. Maybe when you come into the land, you're going to become extremely successful. You're going to build for yourself nice mansions. And your cattle is going to increase. And you're going to amass a fortune. V'ram levavcha, and your heart is going to swell with pride. You're going to feel and see your own success. And you're going to forget Hashem who took you out of Egypt, who brought you through this harsh and difficult desert, extremely difficult terrain that is inhospitable, impossible for human beings to survive there. But I've taken you through that land for 40 years. I've given you bread from heaven, water from the rock. Maybe you'll forget all that. V'amarta b'levavcha, you will say in your heart, the strength, the might of my own hand has given me this wealth, this prosperity. So the pasuk warns us and says, "V'zacharta es Hashem." You should remember Hashem, ki hu anoisim lecha koyach la'asis chayim. He is the one who gives you strength to make a living, to prosper. Now clearly this warning of the pasuk is because the Jewish people are going into a land where it's conceivable that they'll be able to make that mistake. When they were in the Midbar, when their entire existence was miraculous, so then of course they couldn't think that the credit is due to them. But now that they're going into the land where they themselves have to go out and earn a living, well, they will have to engage in farming and in cattle raising and business affairs. So over there, they might come to the thought, to the feeling that this has been, the credit is due to themselves. They might feel the pride. So Hashem says, don't forget and don't take the credit. Know that I am the one who's giving you the blessing. But if that's the case, then the question is, why shouldn't we take any credit? After all, we worked hard. It's hard to make a living. It's tough to make a living. We all know how hard the farmer works, the exertion, the sweat, the toil of the long days, the weeks, the months that it takes in order to produce a crop. The businessman, the headache, the mental and emotional exhaustion to be able to create a good business plan to market the product or whatever else. It was very difficult. So why shouldn't the person slap himself on the shoulder and feel good about what he has achieved and what he has accomplished? So you can say and argue, the pasuk doesn't say not to take any credit. Don't take the full credit. Give Hashem also some credit. Remember Hashem too, that He too is one. He's a partner in all of this. We could say that. But if we look carefully in the words, it seems it doesn't say that. It says, "V'zachartas Hashem ki hu anoisu l'cha koyach la'asus chayim." He is the one who gives you the might to be able to be successful. And also from this that it's telling us, it's comparing it to the days of the Midbar. If all he wants to say is not to take the full credit, because Hashem, of course, has to give us, he's the underlying force in our life. I mean, if he wouldn't be alive, then we couldn't do anything. Of course, thank Hashem for giving me life. And now I'm so smart and I'm able to make panos. If that's all that it would be, then the Pasuk should say that. The fact that it's saying, remember, I took you through, remember the days in the Midbar, when we've gone through that wilderness where a person can't survive, and I've given you bread from heaven and water from a rock. Comparing it to that time, to the miraculous time. So it seems clearly that the Pasuk is trying to tell us that, hey, just like when you were in the Midbar, it was clear to you, you didn't even think for one moment that it was your credit that you survived for. So now too, when you're in the land of Israel, when you're so to speak on your own, when you're not being fed on a golden platter, when you have to do your own work, remember that what you're doing is nothing. I'm the one giving you the strength. So that needs clarification. Why is that? Because working for a living is not just something we do because of our own doubts and our own questions and lack of trust in Hashem. Working for a living is something the Torah commands us to do. Next week in the parasha we have a pasuk, "Uberechacha Hashem Elokecha b'chol asher tase." Hashem is going to bless you in all that you do. Of course, we need a divine blessing, but it's going to be in all that you're doing. Clearly stating that we need the person's action. The person has to work. The Mishnah Tzvul Pirkei Avos we've been learning now in the summer. Toiv Torah im derech eretz. It's good to learn Torah, but with derech eretz, with normal affairs. The Gemara brings a machlokes between two Tanoim, an argument. Reb Shimon Bar Yochai says that a person ought to study Torah all day. All day. What's going to be with parnasa? What's going to be with living? You rely on Hashem. Hashem will provide. Reb Shimon Bar Yochai says, if a person is going to plow in the plowing season and sow in the planting season and harvest in the harvest season, what's going to be with the Torah? So therefore, a person should study Torah and God is going to take care. God will provide. Rabbi Yishmael says, no. That you have to live like a normal human being and go out and work for a living. You have spare time, you'll learn Torah. You'll set time for Torah study. But one is required to make a living. This is a Torah requirement. And the Gemara says like this, many people did like Reb Shimon and studied Torah all day long, and they weren't successful. They failed. And Harba also could Reb Yishmol, and many of them did like Reb Yishmol, but also beyadam, they were successful. Both in achieving Torah knowledge, in their spiritual development, and also in material success. So clearly the Torah is demanding of us that we work for a living. So if it's something that the Torah tells us to do, what's so bad if a person takes credit for his success? I mean, the Torah wouldn't be telling you to do something that is futile. So obviously it's because your work accomplishes something. So why is there such a strict warning? Don't say that. Be very careful. We just got up from the floor. From the morning, it's after Tisha B'Av. And it's a time of, sort of, the heart is free. There is this excitement. Oh, Tisha B'Av is over, the 9 days are over, it's a sad period of mourning. Now we can go on living and have some relief from the stress, from the anxiety. But we know that there is a very intense time looming right over the horizon. The high holidays, Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, the Yom Ha'aroyim, they're coming very soon. Very quick. You know, my grandmother used to say, and talk about the quickness of the Jewish calendar. Soon after Pesach, she would say, oh, Shoshana Rosh Hashanah. After Pesach, it's a bit of Rosh Hashanah. She said, why? She said, if you go, the calendar works like this. It works much better in Yiddish. It's in the Jewish, from Pesach, to the passing of time from Pesach till Rosh Hashanah. Sieben Zeitmen, drei Weintmen, and vier Blustmen, schon in Rosh Hashanah, in English. 7 we count, Pesach, Teshuvah. 3 weeks we cry. 3 weeks. And then 4 we blow shofar. That's the whole summer from Pesach to Shavuot. So, in 2 weeks from now, we're going to hear the shofar blowing, awakening us, reminding us that Rosh Hashanah is coming. You think about Rosh Hashanah, we're going to be coming to Shul, all Jews, with our machzer in our hands. And we're going to say to Hashem, Avinu Malkeinu, Father, our King, Kozveinu b'sefer parnasa v'chakol. Inscribe me in the book of livelihood, in the book of sustenance. This year in particular, this Avinu Malkeinu, this request, is going to be said from the depth of the heart, with great sincerity, far more even than last year. Last year in Erev Rosh Hashanah, when the stock market came crashing down, so the carpet was swept out from beneath our feet. But at that moment, we didn't really realize the severity of what it all means. It just hit us. It was fresh. But after a year in this difficult economy, and it hasn't yet stabilized, let's hope at the time Rosh Hashanah comes, that Shazan good for Yidden, it's going to be good, and Parnas and everything. Mashiach will be long here. So we know that the fear, the intimidation. How many tears are going to be shed when we'll ask the Yiddish, the Jews all over the world, because they knew the Sefer Parnasa the Chakom. Now there's something that should be taking it very seriously. After all, the Gemara tells us in Rosh Hashanah that Gemara says in Gemara's Masechta's Beis. But the Gemara says that on Rosh Hashanah, Mizaynoisa Shaladam Ptuvim Loi, Mirosh Hashanah L'Rosh Hashanah. That a person's Mizaynis, a person's livelihood, is prefixed, it is preset from Rosh Hashanah until Rosh Hashanah. That's when Hashem sets the parnasa that the person is going to earn the entire year. And we all know that there is no wheeling and dealing, and anything we can do to even earn one extra nickel, even 1 cent more, than that which the Eibishter has prescribed to us, Rosh Hashanah. But that brings us to 2 questions. Number 1, what's the point of the davening? Every day, we daven, and we daven for all of our material needs, and we daven for parnas. When we say Ashrei, when we say Paseach HaSyadecha, Mazbi Elochocha Yotzei, Hashem, you open up your hands. The verse is a praise to Hashem, but says that we're supposed to have in mind. Can't speak that, anything that's not the davening. Well, we should have in mind, asking Hashem that He should direct some of that parnasa to us. So there we have a request for parnasa. And then later in the Shemayna Esrei, again, when we get to Baruch Aleinu, it's a request for parnasa. Ben, Chas Hashanah Azoyz, this year is coming, this also, and all of its crap, it doesn't only mean the crop of the grain. Referring to all of our doings that we do for livelihood should be blessed with the divine blessing. But what's the point of davening? If everything has already been set in Rosh Hashanah, what are we asking for every day? And it was the men of the great assembly, it was the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, they were the ones who instituted the davening, the way we daven. If we're going to say that we have access to other resources, that even that which has not been set and given to us on Rosh Hashanah, we can still access it and add to our panas. So then why do we make such a big deal about the Rosh Hashanah davening? So if you miss Rosh Hashanah, you haven't missed the boat. Anytime you're davening, you can elicit the panas. From the way the Gemara says it, it's set, indicates it's set, and it's unchangeable. So the Gemara really asked this question. The Gemara says, "Keman matzlinin o'idna." Our days when we daven every day, according to who does this come out to? That we daven every day, why are we davening? The Gemara says this goes according to Rabbi Yossi. Because Rabbi Yossi said that Adam Nidon B'chol Yoyim, that a person is judged every day. Since we're judged every day, so we have to daven every day. According to the rabbis, according to the other Rabbanim, who say that the person is judged only on Rosh Hashanah, so the davening the rest of the year is useless. And that's why we shouldn't daven for these things. Rabbi Yossi, who holds that we're judged every day, he says that according to him, we have to daven every day. All right. But we know, even according to Rabbi Yossi, the commentators say, that even Rabbi Yossi agrees to the Chachamim, to the Rabbanon, that there is the main primary judgment is Rosh Hashanah. That's where the main, only that there is some form of judgment every day. Clear that Rosh Hashanah is a Yom Adin. No one is going to argue on that. There's psukim that are indicating that Rosh Hashanah is the Yom Adin. So there is a din on Rosh Hashanah. There is some kind of a judgment also every day. And for that we should daven every day. But then we need to understand what's the content of that. What's the content of the judgment of Rosh Hashanah? And what is the content of this specific judgment that we're judged every day? And how does that relate to our prayers, to our davening? The kind of davening that we daven Rosh Hashanah and that which we're intending in our prayers during the year. So that's one question. Second thing is, if our mezainis and if our panas has been set already in Rosh Hashanah, why do we go out and work for a living? If God has decreed, if Hashem has said, this is what you're going to earn, then this is what we're going to get. As mentioned earlier, anything we're going to do isn't going to add one iota to that which Hashem has decreed. And on the other hand, if God has decreed that, then it's going to come to us. Seemingly, whether we go out and try to make some kind of avenue for parnasa, or not. Because Hashem decreed. Ahu amar v'lo yaseh. Does Hashem say, and it doesn't happen? So if Hashem decreed that you're going to have parnasa, you're going to have parnasa. So what's the meaning of this going out and working for a living? The question over here is not why people go to work. When people go to work, people do a lot of silly and stupid things. A person goes to work, go to work. The question is, why does the Torah tell us to go to work? Why does Yiddishkeit demand of us that a person should go to work if seemingly it doesn't have any content and any meaning? And this is a serious question, because this is not something that we do sometimes, once in a while. This is something that most of us are occupy our entire, most of our lives, of our resources, our energy, our focus, everything goes into making a living. Why are we putting so much into something which seems to be utterly futile and meaningless? So to understand that, we have to get a little mystical. To get some understanding about the system through which the divine energy, the godly life force, flows into creation. The Kabbalists speak about a whole Seder Hishtalshelus, a whole order of progression, of worlds, of attributes. But we'll begin first with the inner meaning of Rosh Hashanah. What is the deeper and more Kabbalistic approach to Rosh Hashanah, the Hasidic interpretation of Rosh Hashanah? One of the things that we're busy with on Rosh Hashanah, in the davening, most of the davening, is we are declaring and proclaiming Hashem as king. Most of the davening is about the Malchus of Hashem. In all the piyutim, and all the poetry that we say in Rosh Hashanah, we're speaking about kingdom, Hashem Melech, Hashem Molech, Hashem Yimlech, 1,000 times. And then in the Shemoneh Esrei, the signature of the ending of the primary blessing, Melech HaKol HaOretz, Hashem is the king over the world. So we are constantly speaking about the kingship of Hashem. Musaf. is dedicated to Malchios, to proclaiming Hashem as a king, as the verse, as we, the Gemara tells us, Hashem says to the Jewish people, Imru lefanai, say before me, Malchios kedei shetamlichuni aleichem, say before me verses of kingship, so that you will make me king over you. Even the mitzvah of the shofar, which is the mitzvah of the day, even that is as a result of the coronation of making Hashem as king. We know that, even though most of us know that shofar as a wake-up call for tshuva, but that's only a secondary meaning, a secondary reason to the shofar. Rabbi Nosadya Goyen, who lists 10 reasons for the blowing of the shofar, as the first reason says that the coronation of a king is with the blast of trumpets. With the trumpets and the sound of the shofar, you should blow before the King Hashem. So Rosh Hashanah is the coronation of the king. Now we understand how vital that is, how important. Because to us, because we humans seem to have a very, very short memory and attention span. And we forget things very quickly. So as the year goes by, we drift off. So we need to reorient ourselves. We need to refocus, redirect ourselves, and have the focus that what we're here for, that we're here as subjects of Hashem and we're here to serve Him. So it's needed for us because of our forgetfulness. So to get back online, that we don't see ourselves as the center of existence, but our lives should evolve around serving our Creator. So this requires a reminder once a year. However, in Chassidus and in Kabbalah, it explains that there is a much greater accomplishment. The Rosh Hashanah proclamation, the coronation of the king, is not just for us. It has heavenly impact. Even higher than that, it has godly impact. It affects God. The godly realms. As it says in the writings of the Arizal, that Rosh Hashanah is the time of Binyan HaMalchus, structuring of the kingship, building up the divine attribute of kingship, having a godly effect. We are literally placing Hashem on the throne. We are putting the crown on His head. However, that needs some explanation because of three things. First of all, who are we tiny little peepsqueaks? Little nothings, like a little piece of dust floating in the cosmos and out in the cosmos. Nothing. Blessed us. Has no. Who are we? A nothing of a nothing. To be the ones crowning Hashem. Secondly, why does God need us to crown Him if He's a king? Besides of us, who are we to crown Him? But why does He need anybody to crown Him? And thirdly, why does this have to happen every year? Fine. Hashem has been crowned as a melech, established as a king. Fine. Gegangen weiter. It's done. What does this require the yearly coronation? So the explanation is given that kingship is a very external thing. It's something that a person doesn't need for himself. Kingship, the very definition of kingship, is in a relationship. The king has a relationship to his subjects. He looks out for the welfare of his subjects. He takes care of them. He makes sure they have a livelihood. He protects them. He guards them. And they, on their part, they are dedicated and devoted wholeheartedly to the fulfillment of the dreams, of the wishes, of the aspirations, of the ambitions of the king. They are here to serve him. That's a relationship. That's the definition of Malchus. A kingship can't be a king without a people. Ein melech b'loy am. There is no king without a people. And this applies to God too. Without a creation, Hashem isn't the king. It's only after there is a creation, oh, now there can be a, we can establish a divine kingdom. The creation is his subjects, where he manifests or actualizes his kingdom. We're deeper than that. It works vice versa, the other way around. As a result of God having the desire to be a king, as a result of that, the creation emerges. Creation came into existence out of Hashem's desire that I want to be a king, as stated in Pre-Eitz Chaim. That the first initial stirring within Hashem, whatever that means, within the Ohr Ein Sof, within the infinite light, the first initial movement towards creating a world was Kisha'ala B'Ritzoynoi HaPashut, when it arose in his simple will, Ano Emloich, I want to be a king. What does this mean? For thousands, millions, billions of years, there was no creation. For creation, really, there is no time. It's hard for us to relate to that. So let's think more in time. So for all that past, there is no creation. Suddenly, boom, there is a world with myriads of creatures. Where does that come from? Because Hashem had an interest, decided to create it. What's driving that interest? What's the motivation? What's the force behind it? A dream. A desire. A desire, I want to be a king. You don't want to be a king. Oh, so now there's a creation through which he can be a king over. Actualizes Malchus. Now, initially, the first time when God created the world, Hashem was like a self-imposed king, self-proclaimed king. Because there were no creations to call for this kingship. Because the creations didn't exist until God imagined them. And he imagined them as part of his kingdom. So before he, so to speak, if you can speak about before, whatever that means. But prior, or on a level deeper than that desire of being a king, there is no creations. So there's no one to stimulate it, no one to call forth. So this was a chesed chinam, this came from Hashem. He decided from within himself, I want to be a melech. And he created the world. But that kind of kingship is not fulfilling. Because a kingdom where the king imposes his will upon the people, it's not really delightful. It's not what Hashem desires. He wants a kingship that's coming from his subjects. He wants his subjects to coax him into the relationship. They should elicit within him. They should desire. They should submit themselves from within their own volition. It should be their desire that they want to live for him, for their king. So that, for that reason, Hashem set it up as follows. That his relationship and his contract with the world that he made the first time when he created it, that he is the king and you're my subjects, expires at the first anniversary of creation. He had that desire, and desire lasted a year. At the conclusion of the year, that feeling and emotion or feeling dissipates. When it comes at the eve of Rosh Hashanah, Erev Rosh Hashanah by night, Hashem loses all interest in being a king over the world. The mood changes. There is no desire. So the Kabbalists speak about the miracle, or the question, rather. What is the existence of the world? How is it possible for the world to exist on Rosh Hashanah by night? If the soul of creation, if the nucleus of the world is God's desire, that he desires to be a king, and he manifests his kingship through the creation. If there is no desire, there is no world. So how does the world survive? Takash. It's a good question. Not for now. But what happens? Comes Rosh Hashanah by day. And when all the creations get together, all of Hashem's subjects, and they're not subjects now because there's been that sort of that disconnect, and they come up and they cry out to Hashem, you are our melech and we're your servants. We want to give ourselves over to worship you. And this coronation takes place in all worlds, of all levels of billions of malachim, srafim, vaifanim, v'chayis hakodesh. All the levels of angels all cry out in unison. But the real machers, the real mover and the shakers, of the Jewish people below. Souls that are incarnated in bodies. Why? Because the real thrill and the real enjoyment of kingship is dafka down here below from our service, because we have free choice. Malachim don't have much choice, but we down here have a choice. And when we choose to surrender our egos, our own desire, and our own will, to do lastly sirotzen etzayin malkeinu, to do the will of our king, that's where Hashem gets his pleasure. And that's what calls him into the relationship for another year. Reinvests him, or re-engages God into the world. That takes place every year on Rosh Hashanah. Through our cries, Ki yonu amecha v'yata l'keinu. You are our, we're your servants, we're your people, and you are our king. Now, as a major part of this, we all understand, we know Rosh Hashanah is a Yom Adin, a day of judgment. Now this, that Rosh Hashanah is a day of judgment, is intrinsically and inherently connected to the Rosh Hashanah being the coronation of the king. It's a derivative from the kingship. Because as every respectful businessman, every successful businessman, will from time to time take the time to review his business and review his various different activities, programs that he has within his business, to see if it's yielding a profit, if it's worth it. So if someone, for instance, has opened up a new department in his company, a new product line, and of course, to put out a new product is a whole production. It begins with hiring a whole bunch of people and executives and managers and the regular employers and the marketing department and this department, all the way down to delivery boys and the janitors, so the whole thing. So, but he has all the reason to believe that this will be very profitable. But in the beginning, of course, you have to invest. So he invests, and he gives it. The counsel that he has gotten is, you know, gives himself the estimation of how long it's going to take, a year or so, to be able to see if there is something happening over here. So after the year is up, he takes stock, he looks into it, and he sees what's the bottom line. Has this been profitable or not? Is this working or is this not working? So Hashem too takes his kingdom very seriously. And he seriously looks into this. Is the creation fulfilling for him? Is it reaping rewards, a profit? Is it giving him what he desired when he created it in the first place? And what did Hashem desire? He desired the profit of it being his kingdom. His kingdom being realized by his subject serving him in what sense? In Torah and mitzvahs. That's the way. This is Hashem's desire in this world. So the Torah and mitzvahs is his profit. So he looks at the world based on the year before, on the previous year, and he sees how much Torah and mitzvahs grew out in the world in the past year. How much has this world served me? That's his question. Based on that, he will decide whether and how much to get back involved. Just like the businessman. If he sees super success, so then he comes back and re-involves himself in his business, reinvests himself to a much greater extent. He will put far more resources into this division of a company. He will put in more money, more time. He will build it. Because he's expecting, he sees that it's profitable. If it's been I, so maybe he'll decide to let it go for another year. Check it out, see. If you know, maybe he just needs a little bit more time. Give it another chance. Sometimes he might decide, no, it's not worth it. And he will shut it down. So Hashem is looking at the creation, seriously. See what has happened last year based on that, to decide if this creation is something that is working out. If it's really working. And that's the judgment that is there on Rosh Hashanah. Now the judgment is a twofold judgment. The judgment is a general judgment. How is the creation doing as a whole? And then the question is, how is all the little parts of it? And all the details of it? Just like the businessman, when he's looking into his company. First, he wants to look at the bottom line, profit or not profit. Has this been good or bad? That's the question. And then once he does see that it has been profitable, but he wants it to be successful. So now he's looking based on the performance of all the workers and all those that he hired. And he's going to decide. He's going to channel his money. He already allocated in his mind this year for this, the budget for this division of the company is going to be $5 million. But where is the $5 million going to go? Where is it going to be the best return for his money? Should he have promotions? Promotions? Who should get the promotions? The executives at the top? Or maybe the people at the bottom? Those who are actually producing the product. Should he add more money in marketing? An advertisement or whatever? All these things. Maybe some people have to be fired and replaced with others. So there's a very, very detailed evaluation and accounting going down into the nitty-gritty aspects. Every little part of it. Shem, too, when he looks at the world. He's looking at the overall picture, and then he's looking at the details of all the little aspects. I gave life. I gave certain people a very peaceful year. They had parnasa. Lots of pronouncement, no worries, nothing to... There's tranquility in their lives. Now, what have they done with that tranquility? Did they add more time for Torah study? Did they use that peace of mind for that? Or were they using it to play poker? For other things? Were they using this extra money that I gave them just for their own increasement of their own pleasure? Or have they been using that money, that extra money that I've given them, to support yeshivas or whatever, other things, help other Jews out, to increase Yiddishkeit, Torah and mitzvahs in this world? So if this is profitable, then Hashem says I have to give them more. If God forbid the other way, then I might give the person another chance. Interesting. It says in regards to in Kuntir Sumayin, amazing, very beautiful thought. And he talks about Rosh Hashanah, and the month of El that comes before Rosh Hashanah. So we know that the month of El, for many people, El is God looking at us with his threatening finger and shaking his hand and saying, you better watch out, I'm coming soon, and I'm going to bust you. That's not a Hasidic approach to El at all. El is a time that's called Yemei HaRachamim. It's a time of divine mercy. Incredible mercy of the Eibishter is shining forth. So the example that he gives is this businessman who has many buyers, merchants, who buy merchandise from him. But they buy on credit. I'm going to pay, they don't have the money up front always to pay. So he has a credit line, and he gives for every one of them, this one and that one. Comes towards the end of the year, as he does his accounting, and he sees, this is what I like so much about that mush, and he says, he sees that it was very profitable. So he gets very excited. He's happy. He says, this year I did a lot of business. It was great. But then there were those who didn't pay up. But they have to pay up. So he sends out letters. But the letters are reflecting the mood. They're reflecting the joy, the pleasure that he has with doing business with them. And that he's in such a good mood because it has been so profitable. And he says to them, you know, it's been a very good year, whatever, but you owe me so and so, and I hope you can... By this and this date, I hope you can pay it up. I'm giving you a month to pay up what you owe. They receive the letter, and they can tell, they can sense the energy in the letter. And they can feel that he feels good, but you know, it's a little bit, they start scratching their heads, you know, I have to pay up, I don't have the money to pay up. So they scramble. For 3 weeks, they're scrambling together to be able to pay at least something. 3 weeks are over, they send in their partial payment or whatever they were able to do, maybe just very minimal. And they have a return letter, and they're saying, you know what, I'm trying very hard. I had a little bit difficult this year, and I tried whatever, but I'm paying you whatever I can pay you now. I hope you'll forgive me, and eventually I'm going to pay up. All right. He receives these letters. He sees the goodwill. He can sense that they're sincere about it. He's happy. So he accepts that, and he continues the next year. More than that, he gives them even more, even though he's giving it on credit. Because he knows that he has someone to deal with. Then there are those who totally ignored him and didn't answer his letter and all that. So there, it's different. It might he might just shut down the entire thing. So he says, on Rosh Hashanah, on the month of El is when Hashem starts doing his accounting. When it comes, Rosh Chodesh El. So, And he looks, and Hashem is delighted. See, this is what we don't realize always. The world is very profitable. The biggest proof we're still here after 5,769 years. It's because every year Rosh Hashanah has made it. Because as much as we, all the stupidity that we do, Soif Kol Soif, at the very end, the world is very profitable. God gets tremendous nachas ruach, unbelievable delight. Of all the times we crush our ego, every time we drag ourselves out of bed and we come daven and we put tefillin even if we're not in the mood of it. We come to a shir and we study. We give tzedakah even though when it's hurting. We're not eating something because it's not perfectly kosher. Or we're not looking at something because it's not kosher. Every iskafya, every time we crush, every time we say no, and we overcome the unholiness inside of us, this gives him endless pleasure. At the end of the year, God has what to celebrate. So the month of Elul, he sends those letters out. Remind, they're very friendly letters. They're very nice. Just telling us, you know, we owe him, we got to pay him back. Because we take on credit. He gives us everything, and we're supposed to send back to our enemies. So what do we do when it comes? So we have 3 weeks. 3 weeks we scramble. So what do Jews do? Sometimes we feel uncomfortable. Some people feel like hypocrites if they do extra in the month of Elul. It's not true, you know. The businessman who goes and tries to pay up right before he's asking for a bigger line of credit, not hypocritical. You're doing your best. Now is the time when Hashem sends us the reminder, so we're supposed to add in Torah, we say extra Tehillim, and we check out filling in our mezuzahs. We seek to do whatever we can to clean up the act, to tshuva of whatever things we ought not to be doing, and to increase the good things. But then comes the first week, the Slichas, the week before Rosh Hashanah, and we come to Shul and we say, like poor men, we are banging on your doors because we don't have a lot to pay back. We're paying you a little bit. But Hashem, take the good gesture, the little bit that we're giving, because we really, really want to pay back completely. But give us some more time. Give us another chance. And Hashem accepts it with joy and happiness. Because he sees the sincerity. And in Rosh Hashanah, through our good, through our Kabbalah, and our good acceptance for the year, Hashem gives every year the Lashana Taiva, our good Kabbalah. So, as mentioned earlier, the judgment of Rosh Hashanah is general and individual. Both on how everybody's doing as a whole and then individual. Now, more specifically, Rosh Hashanah, what dominates in Rosh Hashanah, the main factor in Rosh Hashanah, is the collective effect of the Jewish people as a whole in all the Torah mitzvahs that they did. How is the kingdom as a whole doing? Yom Kippur is more about the details, more about all the individuals. And that's what is explained in Chassidus and Kabbalah, is explained that the Yom Kippur is the time when the Bene'ilah is the time of the Chasima. The Chasima is the signature. We say the Chasmeinu in sign. Chasima means the breaking up, the dividing of the allocation. The specific allocation of that which Hashem has delivered to the world, its specification. It's giving it to each individual. Because in Rosh Hashanah, Hashem is giving it in a general form. But when it comes on Yom Kippur, He is giving it, He's slicing it to the individual. So Rosh Hashanah is more about teamwork. That's why it's so emphasized, Achdus. We as a whole, we cry out to the shofar, blowing on the shofar. The 10 days of tshuva that we have. And Rosh Hashanah, Hashem renews his relationship with the world. As we mentioned earlier, the businessman has decided that this year he's pumping $20 million, let's say, into this business, into this part. So the Eibishter too makes his decision. How much of himself, how excited, how much energy is he giving to all the world, to all of creation? That's on Rosh Hashanah. But then over the next 10 days, we split the pie. And everybody hopefully wants to get we call it chaticha roilas chabit, want to get a piece that has enough for all the blessings that you need. That's the inyan of the chasima. That's why Kabbalistically the chasima is connected to the hei gevuros. It's 5 restraining powers that are drawn down into malchus, into the attribute of kingship that take place on Yom Kippur by Ne'ilah. What are the hei gevuros? Why is it called restraining? Because when you take something and you divide it into pieces, that's called restraining, creating the divisions. Just like the mashal is given, like the 5 fingers on the hand. The hand has the koyach ha-maisa, the power of the action, the power to do things. You can do with your hand. But that power of action is very general. And you couldn't do the specific
elements and specific talents, like drawing and painting and playing, you know, piano and all the other things that we do with our hands, and we wouldn't have the fingers. What the fingers do is that they divide it and break it down to the details, enabling the koyach hamaisa to express itself in all the various different forms. So if it would just be out the Rosh Hashanah's amshacha klolis, as a general amshacha, general flow of life, Yom Kippur is with the details, where it's given to the specific people. Every person gets his part. And that's why Yom Kippur is so intense, especially the Ne'ilah moment, because that's when we're literally receiving everything we're going to have for the entire year. Now, more than that, we can't get. Whatever happened to us, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur has been given to us, and that's it. So now we'll look into what happens. What happens the rest of the year? Every day we're davening. What's the point of our tefillos that we daven every single day when it seems like it's all done? It's a done deal. Hashem gave it to us, not only on a general scale, but also in an individual manner to every person, that which they are going to have in all their areas of their life. So what more can be there accomplished during the daily prayer? So the explanation is, even though Hashem has already within himself decided exactly what he's giving to each and every person, but that has not yet been transmitted into the creation. It's still within Hashem's mind. It's in the space within him where he is devoted, in that element in him called Malchus, the attribute of Malchus, which is within God. There is that energy that's there, prepared and set for the creation. But it hasn't been given yet. The actual drawing, the actual giving and transmitting to each and every one of us takes place every day. Hashem creates the world every day for new. Every day he delivers the blessings of the day. A new blessing. So it would be similar to a person having money in the bank, but then you have to draw the funds. You have to come and take the funds out from the bank. So just it being there is nice, but in order for you to be able to use it, you have to be able to draw it out. Every day we draw the funds. Now, here's the thing. For the funds to come down, for the godly blessing, for it to come down into this world, it has to go through a long process. A whole chain-like process. It has to come through many worlds. Because as we know, in general, there are four worlds. The highest world is the world of the divine. That's where the attributes are. The world of Malchus. From there, it has to come down through three consecutive worlds. Olam Abriya, the world of creation, which is the world of souls. Olam Yetzirah, the world of formation, which is the world of angels. And finally, Olam Asiya, which is our physical realm. To come from level to level. And in every world, it needs to, the hashpa, the flow, has to be redefined. What do we mean by that? Hashem has goodies for us. Lots of goodies. He said, I love you, I'm excited about being your king, I want to give you all the good. But what is good? What is good? Many interpretations. What we see is good, a pair of pants, some nice warm socks, blintzes, tuna fish sandwich, cheese omelet. These are good things. It's what we like. In the world of Yetzirah, there is a different kind of a good. And in the world of Olam Abriya, over there is where there's Gan Eden, the Elyon, the supernal Gan Eden. Good is defined in a whole different way. Goodness over there means a divine glow. When godly light radiates on your neshama, when your soul is bathing in godliness, that's good. So this goodness has to channel, has to be redefined. It's like a father that has a few sons. And the father is a brilliant man, he's a sage. He loves his children. And he wants to give all that he has to his children. He has a 40-year-old mature son. What's the goodness he wants to give this child? He wants to stroll with him in the park and reveal to him the inner mysteries of life. He wants to tell him, he wants to speak philosophy. Tell him the secrets of creation, the purpose of life. That's his good that he wants. And the son enjoys it. That's the pleasure of his life, to talk with his father, spend time with him. Son has a 20-year-old, the father has a 20-year-old son too. He wants a Ferrari and or a Mercedes. Don't talk philosophy, I'm not interested in that. And there's a teenager who has a Game Boy or whatever these, I don't even know what the new ones are called. And then there is the little child, the little boy, the little three-year-old who needs toys. And as the mashal is given, the boy, the little boy, likes the father to bring him nuts. But he doesn't like the nuts because he likes to crack the nuts because that's not interesting. He likes the nuts because you can roll them and play marbles with the nuts. Can you imagine? This old man has so much to give to his children. And to his youngest two-year-old, he has to give him shells. Shells, not even the peanut, not even the nut that's inside of it. It's the shell of the nut. That's his delight. That's what he wants to give. So there's a long way to go for the father to refocus himself and realize and to come down, to lower himself down to the world of the little child. So that's what has to take place with the godly hashpah. When Hashem has the goods for us, it has to go through a process from level to level to level until it comes down. And there is a court, there is a Beis Din that judges at each level, is it worth it to squander it and send down that life to a lower level for it to come down lower into the next level. And that's the reevaluation every single day. There is a Din of Mishpat on a person. Are you worthy to draw the funds? It's like when you go to the bank and you want to take out the fund, they ask you for the PIN number. Or your ID. It's my account. Because then, no, show me your ID. So you have to show your ID. We too have to show our ID when we come to draw funds. We probably put in the PIN number. What's the PIN number? The PIN number is that which you... You have to show that you're the same person you were as Hashem. And you made that commitment. And then Hashem is going to give you the good that He promised you to give. And that good that He's giving you, are you going to actualize it in the way that you act, that you promised? So if this godly hashpa is going to materialize and is going to turn into bread and milk and peanut butter. You have to really be worthy for that. Or else it really would be squandering. What happens if the person is not worthy, chas v'shalom, and the hashpah does not come down into gashmi's to get things? And it remains. It remains in your account. It remains up there. And the person is going to receive it in the higher world, in Gan Eden, after 120. It goes into a retiring plan. A retirement. It's going to be for the person at that point. Not everything comes down. However, we understand that we can't leave. A person puts away money. You can't put all your savings, everything into retiring, because then you're not going to make a living. You can't take all your earnings. So you have to have some for living now, and some of it you have to stash away. So too with your hashbah that Hashem has given you neshama. There is that which you put away, and there is that which we have to bring down every day. And that's the meaning of davening. That's the meaning why we have to continuously not just behave on Rosh Hashanah till after Yom Kippur, but the whole year long we have to keep our promises and try to be good Jews. Even for selfish reasons. We have to do it because this is what the Yid is supposed to do. But even if selfish reasons, you have to keep that in mind. That to draw down, even if it's not a free day after Yom Kippur is over, now we're going to have a good time. To remember, responsible. And every day we have to draw down the Hamshach. The Hamshach, the flow comes down into three things. To all the details of our life, primarily in three things. Ban and Chaya Mezayin. Ban is children, Chaya is health, life, health. And Mezayin, livelihood. It has to come down into all three things. Sometimes a person slicing the pie that he got on Rosh Hashanah wasn't so big. And therefore there isn't enough for all three elements of life, health, and children. There might just be enough for two or one. And that's all they get, chas v'shalom. So this we'll understand as a story by the Baal Shem Tov. That a couple came to him, a childless couple, and they were asking him, to daven, they should have a child, to bless them with a child. And the Baal Shem Tov would push them away. I mean, he didn't answer them. And many times, again and again, they came and he didn't push them away. So the Baal Shem Tov never pushed anybody. But he didn't give them the blessing. Till they came and they really insisted and they nagged. And they said, "You." And the Baal Shem Tov finally blessed them. And he gave them the bracha. Oh no, so the Baal Shem Tov made a condition with them. And he said to them, he said, they were wealthy, very... And he said to them, if they're willing to forfeit their parnasa, then he's going to be able to bless them with a child. And they agreed to that, and they lost all their entire fortune, very poor, and they got their blessing, and they had a child. Now the question is, The Baal Shem Tov, let's say, Nishfa Ginnin, the Baal Shem Tov why did he care if they're going to give them both? He give them a blessing. And the answer is because the Baal Shem Tov saw in their source, in their account up there, that there wasn't sufficient funds. There wasn't enough for everything. So they had to figure it out, that the budget, and where it's going to come out. At that time in their life, it was coming down into the, it was materializing into parnas, into abundance of parnas. So the Baal Shem Tov just changed the code, or rearranged, redirected the flow, that it should come down in the channel, should take on a different form, come on a form of children, but then they lost their parnas. That's the inyan of davening every single day. And now we'll understand why we also have to go out and work for a living. It is precisely because of this that the divine flow has to come through many tzimtzum and many contractions, and redefine itself again and again and again, and finally until it can manifest itself in this world as physical blessings. It is for that reason that we are required to go and work for a living. And if a person does not work for a living, then he won't get his parnas. Even if the Eibishter has decreed already on Rosh Hashanah how much this person is going to earn, they will, chas v'shalom, not get it. And the reason for that is, because since it's been channeled down into our world, into the material physical world, the physical world works through a certain system. The way Hashem transmits life and energy into this world is in a manner of concealment. Isn't Hashem transmits anonymously into this world? Since this world is the place where Bechira, where Torah and Mitzvah has to take place, and for Torah and mitzvahs to work, there needs to be the element of bechira, free choice. And if we would see clearly how everything is coming from God, from Hashem, it would be impossible for a person to have free choice. So that's why everything in this world is shrouded and veiled, and Hashem is completely hidden. So the only way a person is going to get his parnasa is if the person is going to provide Hashem with a place to hide. You have to provide a facade, something that God can masquerade in. A veil, a curtain. What does that mean? You have to do something in your life which should give some natural explanation of where you made your money. Without that, Hashem will not give the person his parnas. So it needs to, because there has to be something where God can slip into and unnoticed. That the observer, someone who's observing from the sidelines, would think that the reason why or how this person made his money was because he's a good businessman. Or the business is working out really well. The means of parnasa, the things that we do, have absolutely no bearings at all on our parnasa. That's not responsible at all. That's not giving us anything. Every penny we get is put into our pocket directly by Hashem. The parnasa, the livelihood, is only something to hide, to conceal. It's a lavush, a natural cover-up. That's going to cover up on the miracle of what's called of parnas. Miracles are taking place every moment, but it's shrouded and it's hidden. Of course, the vessel has to be a vessel that should make sense. A person can't say, I'm just going to give any vessel, and then I want to make $1 million, and he makes a silly vessel. Person says, let's say a person needs $100,000 to feed his family. So he says, okay, I'll make a keli. So he's going to open up a barber shop on the on the Mojave Desert. There is a 14 freeway. It goes through cities like Lone Pine, population 66 people. So he's going to open a barbershop from 10 p.m. till 3 a.m. But I need a keli for parnas. So when the trucker is going by and he's falling asleep and he needs something to wake him up, so he goes and get a haircut. Of course. Going to open a barbershop, we'll open it in Beverly Hills, and we'll charge $85 for a haircut. No, actually. Not because the barber, because that the business is giving him his parnas, it's because the Eibishter is giving him parnas. But if he's going to make $100,000 in the barbershop in the middle of Yehupitzville, it's going to be clear that it's a miracle. Parnassah he got because Hashem gave it. But there it would be open, it would be conspicuous that it's coming from God. So you have to do something that for an average onlooker or people observing it from the side can say, oh yeah, it's a chacham. He's a smart man. He knows how to do business. But as we know, as it says, loy lechachamim lechem. It's not the wise men bread. All the natural elements that we see, that we call nature, is only a facade. Cover up on the truth. The world is lying. The world is deceiving. The world is called olam. Olam means concealment, deception. It's an alma de shikra. It's a world that lies. You ask people, even a religious Jew, a very frum, very... I ask him, bread, where does bread come from? And bread comes from the earth. How does it come from the earth? You plant seeds in the earth, it produces wheat, and that's weird. And then you take the wheat, and take out the kernels, and the kernels are ground, you make flour. So, but if it comes from the earth, why are you blessing God? They say, God created the earth. Shem created the world. You have to thank Hashem for making an aretz, hamoytzi lechem, an earth that gives forth bread. Or better, you say, well, that's it. God made it already 5,769 years and didn't enough, and we thank Him enough for something that He did all the way back then. So He said, nah, it's not only that. Of course, you need Hashem's assistance because Hashem has to send the rain. When the rain won't come, then the earth itself won't work. So you need Hashem's assistance. Or worse than that, or say, Hashem can ruin it. Hashem can ruin the crop, can destroy it. So you have to ask Hashem not to interfere. You have to thank Him for not messing it up. But people think the earth gives forth, but the earth gives forth bread. But that's not true. And the proof to that is, you see how the Torah tells us this week, we're supposed to remember the days in the Midbar. Let's imagine the Jews who were in the desert. They were in the desert for 40 years. For 40 years, bread fell from the sky. When they ate the man, they said, "Amoytzi lechem min hashamayim," thanking God for the bread that came from the sky. Now, after a year of the man falling, every day it's falling. So you'll ask a Jew and you say, "Take a look. Look at the heaven." And you'll ask the Jew, you say, "Where is your bread coming from?" He said, "Bread is coming from Hashem." He said, "No, bread is coming from the heaven." He said, "God created a new heaven, a heaven that gives bread." Hashem never made a heaven that gives bread. Or you'll say that for 40 years, the heaven of the sky in the Arabian desert was a different kind of a heaven. It was a heaven that rains bread. So you're insane. The heaven is the same heaven, and heavens don't give bread. It happens to be that Hashem was giving bread, and He was giving it from the heaven. And that was clear. Now let's imagine a boy who was born 10 years into the Jews being in the desert. And he grows up for the first 30 years in his life. He sees bread falling from the sky and water coming from a rock. Okay? He comes into Eretz Yisrael for the first time with Yeshua. They cross the Yarden, and he comes in and he goes ballistic. He goes crazy. He's so excited. He's running around. He says, look at the miracles. God promised us an amazing land. This land is, the miracles in the land is unbelievable. The earth is giving bread. These green stuff coming from the earth. Is normal. Bread comes from heaven. Bread comes from the heaven. Bread doesn't come from the earth. It's a miracle. Hashem is giving us bread. Hashem is giving it. Coming from the earth. But the earth doesn't give bread. I remember in the desert, it's dead soil. Nothing grows on the earth. This is a miracle. Now, which perspective is true? Our perspective. Just like in the Midbar, the heaven doesn't give any bread. The Abish that gave bread. It was coming from the heaven. The same exactly. Hashem never created an earth that gives bread. God gives bread. Hashem feeds every cow with its parnasa on that particular. He is there giving it. He is masquerading under the veil, under the mask of what's called nature of earth. And he's every single time everything grows from the earth, it's exclusively only 100% Hashem doing it at that very moment. Because what's the difference? 40 years. You say, for 40 years, what's the difference to 5,769 years? 40 years, it's okay to say that it was a constant miracle. And because the world is close to 6,000 years old, this can't be a constant miracle. It's only that this is what we're accustomed to. We see this every day. So we look at it as nature. Nature isn't true. The Chacham Tzvi says that nature is repetitive miracles. Every moment, miracles. We experience sunlight. The sun warms, gives light to the world. The sun doesn't give light and the sun doesn't give warmth. Hashem is shining, Hashem is giving warmth and light. Each and every day we say it in davening. He shines to the earth and to those who live on it. He is hiding behind the mask of the sun. He is shining. It's His warmth being covered up and coated by a sunlight that it did. Hashem needed a sun to give light. He can give His light without it. In this world, everything has to be shrouded. And the same is also with the laws of economics and everything. There is no such laws. These things don't. It's only in our eye, because of their repetition, it seems to be this way. Every penny we earn is given to us directly. Hashem gives us every penny, every little thing. But we have to make, we just have, all we're doing with our panasa is creating something to hide His blessing. Until Mashiach comes. When Mashiach comes, it says the earth is going to give forth cookies. Everything is going, whatever we need is going to grow from the earth. Because then there won't be the need anymore for the concealment. Until Mashiach comes, there has to be concealment. That's the whole point of what we're doing in Parnassa. It's when we have that attitude, our whole way of thinking and our connection changes. This interesting story. The Dubna Magid once told the story as follows. He said there was a very, very hungry man. A poor man. He's been traveling for days, he hadn't had any food. He came to a town and he heard that in this town there is a rich man, a very benevolent person, a generous, a kind man. And he gives free lunch for everyone. And it's a beautiful lunch. So he schleps himself, he gets the address and he comes to the house. And he knocks on the door. And he didn't really figure it's about 11:30, soon must be lunch. And he's starving, can't wait to sit down. And the man opens the door. The problem he made was he by mistake walked up to the neighbor's house. Now that neighbor was also a very wealthy man, lived in this beautiful mansion, but a very, very stingy person. And a mean spirited person. So he sees this guy walking up, and he says to him, "What are you doing? What do you want?" He says, "I came for lunch." So he right away understood that he's coming for lunch, not to his house. He's coming, he's intending to go to the next door. But he figured he'll take advantage of the situation. So he tells the guy, he says, he came a little early, lunch is not going to be served till about 1:30. And meanwhile, he says, the custom is when people come to me for lunch, they do work for me first, and then we have lunch. He says, "If you don't mind coming, I'll show you what I need done." So he takes him down to his storage, and he has his big, huge logs. And he tells this poor guy to go and start. I need firewood, so I want you to chop the wood. And then when you're done chopping all these logs, I want you to take the rope and put them into bundles. You'll make me bundles of firework. The poor man doesn't have any other means to eat lunch. He says, "All right." Takes the axe, and he's sitting and he's banging and he's clapping with him. So the work is so difficult. More than that, he by mistake chops, he injures himself, and then he gets splinters from the wood, and his hands are torn from the rope, and he's nebuch. Bleeding and all the way to kracht and to brachim. He's done with this finally after. He looks at the clock, it's 1:30. He's only, he did whatever he did. And he comes up and he says, "Okay, now I'm finished, but now I think, can I go in? Where is lunch being served? Where's the dining room?" So this guy said, "Oh, yeah, dining rooms, you go outside through the alley and knock at that door. Lunch, the dining room is in the next home over." So he goes out. He says, "Oh, look at this guy, so wealthy. He has two mansions, one next to each other." He knocks on the next door, and they open up. This time he's at the right house. And they're looking at the poor guy, and they see him all there. They right away rush. They bring him in. They wash him off. And they bring him, they clean him up. They give him to drink, and they bring him to the meal. And he has this scrumptious meal and all that. And when he's ready to leave, the owner, the balabayas, comes over to him and wishes him well and says goodbye to him. So the guy says, "What an incredible meal. Your meal, your wife is in. Unbelievable cook, and thank you for me, it was worth all this hard, difficult work for the meal." So the guy says, "What work? What work? What do you mean it was worth all? What the work did you do?" So he said, what do you mean? I was chopping wood and all this, and I look at me all. It was very, very difficult work. I haven't worked as hard as that in a long time, but it was worth it. So he right away understood what's going on. So he said, listen here. He says, lunch is for free. And do was hacked holes, and you were hacking wood also for free. You're hacking in the wood, nothing to do with the lunch you got. So the Dumna Magid said this, a parnasa, the Eberstu gives parnasa. God gives parnasa to every single person. Why do we have to work? We have to work because Hashem cursed Adam. And he said to him, by the sweat of your brow you can eat bread. So you have to hack holes, that's clapping at the bank. There's nothing to do with the parnasa that I'm giving you. I'm giving parnasa miraculously. According to the mystical explanation, we're not knocking and banging wood for nothing. We're providing a keli. The making of the thing is to create some kind of... But the keli is not a partnership. Isn't adding anything to the parnasa. It's just a place where Hashem can hide. The difference comes out. How do we see if a person really is seeing that and living that way? The difference is if a person is willing to cut Yiddishkeit in order to increase his parnasa or his work. If a person goes running out of shul quickly because he has to run to his business, he figures he'd be late. Or if a person is running, doesn't come to daven with a minyan at all because he feels he's late, he's got to, how can he not? Or he doesn't have time to go to any shir. He just should never shir Torah every day because he's too occupied with his business. It's a clear demonstration that the person sees and feels that it's his business that's the source of his success. If you know that God is the source of your success, that Hashem is the one giving you, and the business is meaningless, it's only providing something. So what sense does it make to cut on Hashem's blessing and say to Hashem, I don't have time for you because I need to go out and make a mess? It's almost sadly the times when Jews had to get there, whether it was in the camps or in the times in Russia, when food was rationed. And everybody had to come and get the card to get your card, and you get a roll, a loaf of bread, and a little bowl of soup. So they'd get onto a line, and they would give you a ticket, a food card, a card. And then there was the man with the big bowl, and he would fill. So there were bowls, everybody had to go get a plate. And there's all kinds of plates. There were nicer plates, and dirtier plates. So imagine someone standing on the line, and he's waiting to get the card. And from the corner of his eye, he's watching the plates are being taken, one after another. And then he sees all these guys, he's probably going to end up with a little bit of a cracked plate or maybe a dirty plate. So he's getting all intimidated because he wants to get the plate. So as he sees this line, it's never ending, the line to get the card. So he gets out of the line and he goes onto the other line to get the bowl. So time he finishes, gets his bowl, the man with the cards isn't there anymore. So he comes up to the guy's giving the soup and he presents him with the card, with the bowl. And he says, no. So he says, what? No, is your card? I don't have a card. So what do you mean I have a card without, like they said in the Chinese shirt guys, no tiki, no shirty. You're not getting anything. There's no, said, so yeah, but I have a bowl. What do you mean I have a bowl? You need a card. Davening every day with a minion, that's when you get your food card. Being by a shir Torah, that's when you get your food card. You need to get a bowl. If the bowl won't be that perfect, V'hu yachal kalecha, Hashem is going to already provide the finishing of the keli. But it's literally ridiculous. And that's the biggest test of it. Because to us it appears so much that it is our parnasa that is really giving us success. But these hard times, and we can only live with this amunah. And Jews have this amunah because we are be'etzem aminim. We have this within us. We just have to dig it out. That Hashem is the source of our parnasa. It removes so much anxiety, all the fear and the nervousness. Because the only thing you need to do is make sure that you are doing the right thing with the Eberstu. In the Parnasa, you do something. The right thing for a person to make a cheshbon into what you should invest in your Parnasa time should start something like this. First thing you need to figure out, how much time do you need to sleep to be a mensch? Okay, or else you don't function. I need 6 hours, 8 hours. Okay, I need 6 hours for that. 7 hours for sleep. Then I need to daven. Daven with a minyan. And not the express minyan, 20 minutes from when you put on the tefillin until you're out the door. To daven, daven means davening. Say, I have an hour minyan. Then I have to daven mincha ma'ariv. Mincha, 20 minutes. Ma'ariv, 15 minutes. So that's an hour and 35 minutes ready for davening. Plus the sleep. then I need to learn with my children. Then I have to go to a shiur Torah, at least 1 hour a day I should study. Then I have to spend time with my children, learn with them, do their homework, learn with my kids. As a mensch, I should spend a little time with my wife. Whatever you finish doing all these things, then you have your remainder time based on that. That's what you say, Krishna. That's what I have to make a keli, accept my keli. And the Abishtha will give the parnas, because it's all he wants from you. Why not if we start the other way around? Say, first I'm going to make sure I'm busy with my business all day, and whatever, some little time, you have no time for your children, no time for your wife, no time for your davening, no time for anything. Emunah, that the Abishtha is, kihu anoisimacha koyach la'asis choy. It's the Abishtha that gives us the strength to make parnas. So let's say even in this hard times, the economy came crashing down, people lost a lot of money from the economic breakdown. People say, well, it was such a bad year. Everybody suffered from the... It's not that the economy, that the stock market crashed down and all the people suffered. There was a specific decree on each person. That person lost because Hashem decreed it upon him. Every single person individually. There's no collateral damage by God, that he does something and then because he intended one guy and everybody else had to suffer. That doesn't work by Hashem. Because we know how many people made a fortune in the last year. When everybody else was losing, those who were meant to make money made their money. And as every businessman will attest clearly, that they can go to their business and work for weeks and months and plan and do all kinds of things, and they don't make a cent. And you know where their parnasa comes from? From a coincidental meeting where they happen to bump into a person and that person, from there, the whole parnasa came from. It's clear that parnasa has nothing to do with what we're doing.